Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mames, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dave Whitlock, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing art and illustration. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our second announcement so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyright and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dave Whitlock about fly fishing art and illustration. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their clean angling pledge. The Federation won National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Dave, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Dave's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Dave Whitlock's book, Trout and Their Food, courtesy of Skyhorse Publishing. And to find out more about the books that Skyhorse Publishing offers, you can visit their website at www.skyhorsepublishing.com. It's www.skyhorsepublishing.com. Now, you want to get this book because you're going to learn a lot about it, and plus it's got a lot of Dave's illustrations in this book, so you'll see a lot. It's like a picture book of his artwork as well in there, so you want to try to win this. Now, here's how you can do it. You got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question is going to be something that Dave and I talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and be fast about it at the end of the show, and maybe you'll win the Dave's book, Trout and Their Food. Tonight, our guest is Dave Whitlock. Dave is one of the most well-known and highly respected individuals in the world of fly fishing. He is a native Oklahoman who, 35 years ago, resigned his position as a research chemist and pooled his talents in painting, illustrating, writing, photography, fly fishing, and lecturing to embark on a new career as a full-time professional in the art of fly fishing. All his works, especially his art, reflect the realism of nature and related fly fishing subjects through the eyes of the sportsman. His diversity has always taken him to new and creative directions, including, in recent years, trout stream design and restoration. Dave regularly contributes his fly fishing art, photography, and writing to many publications such as Fly Fisherman Magazine, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, Trout Magazine, In Fisherman, and Field and Stream. He has written and illustrated four books, Dave Whitlock's Guide to Aquatic Trout Foods, the L.L. Bean Fly Fishing Handbook, the L.L. Bean Bass Fly Fishing Handbook, and Imitating and Fly Fishing Natural Fish Foods for Lefty's Little Library. Dave has also co-authored or made contributions to many other books. He also demonstrates his fly fishing and teaching skills in 7 videos and through guest appearances on televised fly fishing programs. Dave's experience and his devoted and objective outlook on the whole spectrum of fly fishing has earned him consulting assignments from top companies such as 3M Scientific Anglers, Bass Pro, Sage Rods, and Sims Fly Fishing Gear. He designed and directed the first 10 years of all the L.L. Bean fly fishing schools. Dave is recipient of many awards, including Max Anders Wild Trout Award in 1976 for his work on propagation of wild trout and the Federation of Fly Fishers Conservation Man of the Year Award in 1981. Well, Dave, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, hi, Roger. It's good to be back. Man, I got all kinds of stuff to talk about.
You do?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that we probably talk about my artwork. Well, I'm sitting right in the center of my studio, so I've got good karma all the way around me.
Oh, you do? Okay. Well, don't get distracted and start drawing or painting there.
Well, I might do a little bit of doodling.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, we got a bunch of questions, and this show is very different. And we've never done anything like this before. We did talk with the Becks about photography. We did do a show on photography, but never on artwork. So this is a new place to go for us. Of course, you're well known for your art, and so who better to talk about it than you?
A lot of your art that I've done over the years is really very instructive. And so quite often the guests probably are listening have learned from some of the illustrations, as much as they have the text and stuff that they read.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the first book that I remember seeing your work in is The Guide to Aquatic Trouts. And that was when I think I was a teenager. I wasn't quite a teenager. I guess I was about 30 years old or so. But anyway,
30 years old. 30 years old seems like a teenager to me since I'm 77 now.
Yeah. But I just remember you talking about instructive. Looking at all the insects and how they swim you're right. It was I learned all kinds of things about what's happening under the water in that book. But, tell me, you know, we mentioned in your bio that you were in corporate America for a while, and then you switched and went pretty much all into fly fishing. So which came first, the fly fishing or your art?
Well, you know, probably simultaneous because I've always enjoyed fishing, even since when I was a child, and I always enjoyed drawing pictures about wildlife and natural subjects. I kind of got started off with waterfowl first, but it wasn't very long before I really found out that my real passion was aquatic art. So I pretty well, moved away from animals and birds and started the fish thing. And it's been my passion all my life to do it.
Now, did you have any formal art education or training?
No, not really. You know, of course, I went through, I did graduate from high school, but during the high school, I had art teachers that attended art classes. But, you know, Roger, I'm not sure I learned very much from them. It always seemed like that the teaching opposed what I really thought I wanted to do with my art. So I wasn't really anxious to pursue art through an education if that was going to be what I had to put up with in order to do what I wanted to do. Having said that, I wish I had been able to have gone on to college and gotten a degree in art. It would have helped me a lot. But as it was, I didn't, but I continued just to practice on my own. And, you know, it took probably a lot longer to do it, but at least I was able to develop my own style and be content with the kind of work I was doing.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's interesting. My father, who's 81 now, he just started watercolor painting, I guess, about 12 years ago. never painted a thing or drew a thing in his life up to that point. And started way late in life. I think he's done about 43 paintings now.
It really
helped him out and kept him busy, you know, in his retirement. So you can learn on it. He just basically took a couple classes, but just fiddles and, like you say, doodles.
Well, I've been, around a number of very successful artists, and most of them, you know, have counseled me into the sense that to follow my own path with the art, if you're really going to be recognized as a special artist rather than just trying to pursue what everybody else pursues.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, you have to have, you know, your personality has to be there in your
Absolutely.
Work. Yeah, did you start out drawing and then move to painting, or?
Yeah, I did. You know, of course, you know, think of a kid 4, 5, 6, 10 years old, about their only mechanism of doing anything in the way of illustration is with a pencil or a Crayola, you know. And, in fact, I guess that a lot of my earlier drawings got me into more trouble than they did praise, because I guess I was an early graffitiist, because I would draw or Crayola on almost any flat subject I could find, whether it was a wall or a sidewalk or the top of my desk in school, of course. So I was getting spankings for what I make money for right now.
Well, your teachers would be very proud of you today, I'm sure. But little did they know, huh?
No, that's right.
Now, you said you started when you were very young, so
yeah.
Obviously it was much more of a hobby for you for many years, I take it.
Yeah, it was just a pleasure for me, yeah. One of the things is that most of my early life, until I was 9 or 10 years old, I was pretty much wheelchair and brace or bedridden. I had polio and a really bad heart disease, rheumatic fever, and so I couldn't carry on a lot of the normal activities of a boy, you know, that was that age. So the artwork and that sort of thing and fishing and what have you allowed me to have an activity that I could do, you know, without being real mobile.
Well, that's certainly the right activity and give you a lot.
But I think though, gradually that once I began to fly fish was about 9 years old. I think that each time that I went out, I got a little healthier, and a little bit more flexible, a little stronger. And I think I gradually overcame all of those handicaps through the sport of fly fishing, because it was such a wonderful way, to escape, the bonds of the crippling things that I had. And even today, I still think it's the key to my health is the activities that I do outdoors.
Well, you just told me before the show started, you and Emily were out canoeing and small bass fishing last week, right?
Small bass fishing up in Wisconsin, yeah.
Yeah, so
you're
still
wonderful.
Very active.
Oh, yeah. I guess I can do everything that I could do when I was 40 or 50, but I just do it a little slower now, a little more cautiously,
Yeah, I hear you.
I still work out, still, bike and swim and canoe and everything in order to stay in shape just so I can do my fishing.
Yeah, there you go. Well, we had a question from Martin Coleman, Lawrence, Kansas, and
mm-hmm.
Martin's a longtime listener of our show, and one of his
mm-hmm.
questions was, where do you find inspiration for your artwork? Is it mm-hmm. underwater viewing, or do you use your imagination?
Yeah, Martin, that's a good question. A little bit of both. One thing is that I think, that anything around water, whether it's on the surface of the water or below the surface of the water, is extremely fascinating. And when I catch fish or whenever I watch a stream or anything else, I get so motivated to try to create that illusion, on either canvas or paper or what have you. So I use a little bit of all of it in order to get my inspiration, but I have never had a time in my life when I wasn't inspired with the outdoors and particularly the aquatic part of it. It's just any little puddle of water, any drip of water anywhere attracts my attention when I'm driving or walking or what have you. And there's always something living in it and some story to be told about it.
Yeah. I was just up backpacking this past weekend and, up here in the Rocky Mountain National Park, and beautiful streams up there. But I was sitting pumping filtering water, at this little brook, and yeah, it made me think, you know, gosh, the whole world, even in that little brook where there's not even any fish, the life going on there is incredible. And we don't even see most of it, you know.
Now, the minute you go under the water, and that was one of the things that inspired me to become an aquatic artist, is that when I started diving with a mask and fins, you know, when I was in my very early teens, I was shocked at how wonderful it was in a clear stream, you know, how beautiful it was. And just like I had gone to another planet.
Yeah.
And you know, it looks different, it is different, and it runs on a little bit different set of rules, but I just felt so compelled to show that to people, you know, because I think a lot of folks just always see the water through the top of it.
Yeah.
You don't have to get in and go below it like a fish, you know.
Yeah.
Because the minute you do, you just enter another world.
Yeah. They you know, in some of the live, the filming that's being done by a lot of our fellow fly fishermen out there nowadays underwater is just incredible.
Well, you can see what I mean. Boy, it just, man, it knocks your eyes out when you see it, boy.
Yeah. Now, and this question just came in on the internet, and that goes along with the next question I was going to ask. But Terry Little in Fort Collins asked, "Do you use digital photographs to capture images that you later use for reference?"
I do that to some extent. Yeah, I do that to some extent, particularly you know, in the underwater scenarios. If I'm trying to create a realistic, you know, waterscape of a particular stream, I almost always try, if I possibly can, to take some underwater shots of at least, you know, the bottom and the vegetation and the color of the water and what have you. Sometimes getting good fish shots is very, very difficult unless you catch a fish and lead it up to the camera or something, you know, to get the quality that you'd need to actually paint a portrait of that fish that lives there. Because they're fairly elusive, and as soon as they move a little bit away from you, you know, all their color goes away, and of course the detail does too. So most of the streams and stuff that I attempt some type of underwater landscape of, I do try to photograph them.
Mm-hmm. What about like fish? You said they're hard to get underwater. Do you use live subjects there to?
If you really want, you know, to photograph a fish like you would want to see in a painting underwater, in other words, reproduce it, you'd pretty well have to catch the fish and bring it up on a fly or on an invisible tether in front of the camera to take the picture. Because you're going to, in order to get a decent picture, you can't be much more than 2 feet away. And to get that close to a wild fish and get him to pose properly without him being tethered is very, very difficult for the time that the person might have to do it.
So they don't take directions well down there, do they?
No. If you had a weak delay there, you know, and they would accept you and go ahead and continue to do their thing, but a lot of times you only have a few hours. And so, you know, if you want to get that, if you want to actually photograph a brook trout in a stained colored stream, you pretty well have to catch that fish and leave that to the camera, because if it's 10, 5, 6 feet away, it's just kind of a shadow more than it is actually a form.
Well, like, take for instance the illustration you did for the cover of Trout and Their Food. Nice brown trout there. Now, so this has always been kind of my question is, you know, we never really see what they look like underwater. So as an artist, do you try to combine what we see when we pull them out of the water and what we're seeing under the water? Or are most artists kind of paint what we see, what we know out of the water? You understand
what
I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand, sure. You know, I try to do a combination of both. Because the customer or the viewer's expectations need to be served, and if all of a sudden something looks completely different than they have imagined it to look, then they're disappointed in it. And so I try to, you know, I try to split the difference between realism and what people expect. And it's not bad to do that. It's very easy to do that. You know, it's just a situation where you just have to be conscious of what you're, you know, what really supposed to look like.
Yeah.
And a lot of
yeah.
folks like never realize that when a trout is in a stream, their belly is actually darker than their back. And usually, when you look at a fish out of water, their back is always dark and their belly is always light. But the way the light comes down through the water, it hits the back and shades the belly.
Uh-huh.
And so you have to, and sometimes I call it water, light lensing. As water changes shape on the surface, it creates lenses. And one spot will be a very tight, bright spot, and then maybe a quarter of an inch from that, it'll be almost dark, just because that the light is refracted in so many different angles that you get bright and dark right next to each other across the back of a trout.
Yeah, kind of dappled, huh?
Yeah, and the other thing to complicate it, especially in a stream, but also in a lake or still water, is that those reflections that are coming down that way are moving all the time. In other words, so that bright spot is running down the back of that trout. You know, maybe 8 or 10, 15 of them running down his back at the same time. And so if there's a movement of those reflections down the back, as well as a very strong contrast in the light of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dave, we need to take a quick commercial break here, but
okay.
We'll be right back with you, and we'll talk more about fly fishing.
Okay, Roger.
Demonstration. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Dave Whitlock about fly fishing art and illustration. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Dave.
One other thing, Roger, that I wanted to add to that last little discussion about what trout
sure.
look like, what fish look like under the water.
Uh-huh.
Another thing that has a great effect on it is the color of the water. And so if you're used to looking at a fish through a polarized lens that's in your net, you know, you see the true light colors on it. But once it goes under the water, that water, the angle that you're taking the light on, changes that color a great deal. So.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's where the artist has to, like you say, combine the
that's
two
that's right.
scenarios
yeah.
and come up with
yeah.
something that the viewer expects to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ken in Maryland wrote in and he says, Dave, thanks for your contributions. Your art and illustrations have been a great benefit to the masses. His question is, as you study fish, a brook trout, for example, do you find that each one is unique, like a fingerprint? And if so, do you attempt to reflect that uniqueness in your art?
Well, Ken, actually, every fish is different. If you took 100 brook trout that were 10 inches long, none of them would have the same fingerprint. And so, but there is a general, you know, common pattern to each fish, the male and the females and their ages and how their spots and what they eat, et cetera, has some effect on those color patterns. But once in a while, if someone wants me to paint a fish that he has caught, I actually do a spot for spot, you know, portrait of it, just like it is. But in general, whenever I paint a fish that's not as a portrait, I try to use a very random marking pattern because most fish have that. There's not any two of them that are alike.
Okay, good. But they all look alike to us, don't they?
Well, they do. You know, they do. But if you, you know, but if you start and look at the dots and the O's, you begin, or the X's, you see real quick like there's a...
Yeah. It's just that we're only usually looking at one at a time, right? So,
Well, I find that fascinating. I love to do that. I love those differences that way.
And you know, I think they take on too the colors of their stream and so forth.
They do. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I read a book, and actually it was talking about evolution of species, and
uh-huh.
they were talking about, they did a study down in, I think it was down in the Caribbean somewhere on one of the islands, and they did it with guppies, you know,
mm-hmm.
freshwater guppies.
Mm-hmm.
And they put them in, they let these all from the same family, I guess. They put some in a sandy bottom,
uh-huh.
and they put some in a pebbly gravel bottom, two different locations. And they left them there to just naturally breed for like a year, and they came back. And the guppies had taken on different coloring configurations based upon the color of the bottom of the pools that they were in.
Yeah.
And the ones that were on pebbles had more spots, and the ones that were on sand were almost spotless. And I thought that was very interesting, where the fish were adapting and taking on the camouflage.
Well, you know, you take just a, we'll say a rainbow trout or brown trout, that fish in a clear, shallow stream will have very distinct markings and very heavy chroma. But if that same fish is brought out of a very large river or a lake, it will be very silvery and have almost no spot pattern and very little color, because they're trying to reflect, you know, the color patterns that are around them so that they'll blend with them.
Right. Just like steelhead when the rainbows go out to
sea. Yeah, they're almost colorless sometimes when they first come in, because they've been basically, you know, in the ocean, and there's absolutely nothing around them that influences the color other than just the color of the water, you know?
Very interesting. We had a question from James in Jackson, Tennessee. James wanted to know what you consider to be the most beautiful fish, either as a fisherman or as an artist.
Yeah, well... There's a lot of really pretty, ones, and I think that most people really love the brown or the brook trout as far as the trout family is concerned, is just because they are so vividly marked with color. Although, what the fish you just mentioned, the steelhead, there's nothing that's really any more beautiful than a chrome steelhead. You know, as far as as how gorgeously metallic they are. But about a year and a half, about 2 years ago now, I was fishing in Bolivia for golden dorado, and I really believe, Roger, that they're the most beautiful fish I've ever held in my hands. They have incredible chroma on them, and some of the wonderful markings, and the colors and the stripes on them and what have you, it's breathtaking, you know. So it's kind of one of my very current favorites right now, but I'd say that the fish that in North America are probably the brown trout, my favorite, just as far as the coloration of it and the way they look. A really pretty wild brown trout.
So did you do some paintings of a golden dorado?
Yes, I did. Yes, I have. In Bolivia and Argentina, you know, where the folks were that were catching them. They're wonderful fish. God.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's exciting. That's a whole other show right there that I've been thinking about doing, is on the golden dorado.
I think, personally, the golden dorado, which is basically, let me explain, are a freshwater fish. You know, a lot of people associate the word dorado with a saltwater fish. But they also call that particular dorado a dolphin, too, but which is a misnomer. But the golden dorado is a freshwater fish that lives in South Central and then into South America, and they're cool to warm water fish. They live in mostly rivers, but they also stay in lakes. But they are the most ferocious and hardest fighting fish I've ever taken in fresh water, fish for fish. I've just never seen. I think they're the best package we have as far as catching them on a fly rod in fresh water, because they can They all jump a lot. They jump as much as the tarpon. They make long runs, and you just simply can't tire them out. You know, no matter whether it's a 6-pounder or a 40-pounder, they wear your butt right down to the nub. So they're marvelous fish.
That's terrific. Let's talk about...
The thing is, they're a little too far from here. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I know how that is.
Because they are so ferocious, they would never stalk them in our waters. You know?
No, they'd eat everything. Kind of like a biker.
Yeah, eat much more than that even, you know.
Really?
They're kind of like a musky cross with a pie, you know.
Wow, that sounds exciting, though.
Well, they are. They're fantastic.
Yeah.
I think everybody should put that on their bucket list to get down and fish those rather someday.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your work process.
Okay.
I think people will be interested in how you go about things. So when you are getting ready to draw or paint something, what's your first step? How do you get organized?
I give it quite a bit of thought before I, you know, maybe sometimes I try to think about it from at least a week to a month before I even start doing it, you know. In other words, just so that I can sort of, you know, think about all the angles of it, what I want to do. And then when I start off with just a very simple pencil sketch on tracing paper. And that's a nice media to work with because it's easy to erase. And I work out the general shapes and the general design on the tracing paper, and then I transfer that image to sort of a final piece of material that is a little bit more like a plastic film. And when I get that, it'll carry the detail better, and I go ahead and work the detail up of that on that thicker paper. It's called vellum, and a lot of architects use it. But anyway, I work that up on that, and then once I get that right, then I go over it with ink, and I transfer then with a light board that image onto the canvas or to the illustration board. And then from that point on, I put the color on.
Oh, I see. Okay, so it's a several-step process, you know.
Yeah.
So you go to tracing paper to vellum, and then how do you get from the vellum to the ink?
Well, normally what I do, because I'm still working with lines, you know, no shading.
Right.
And so I'll take, once I get the pencil in or the vellum the way I want it, then I go over it with India ink on the rapidograph, or third of course black ink pen, and then I put it on a light board, and that shines through the paper I'm going to put it on.
Oh, I see.
And then I just trace that off with a real light leaded pencil onto the canvas or to the illustration board, and then from that point on, then I just start laying the paint down on it.
Okay. Now, do you, and we had a question from Rick Takahashi in Fort Collins, who's been on our show, too. He wrote a book on pigeons, which is a great book. He said, what brand of colored pencils do you use for your illustrations, or do you use watercolors, and so what brand? Do you use watercolors or oils or acrylics?
Well, I use watercolors, Winsor & Newton watercolors. But I don't watercolor nearly as much as I used to. Once I discovered the colored pencils, I have fallen so much in love with them for the type of work that I do, which is basically first and still foremost, illustrations for books and articles that I write, and also a lot of graphic illustrations for the screen design work I do. And the colored pencil is so fantastic for that. It's just unbelievable. The brand that I use most of them is Prismacolor.
And
that's a relatively inexpensive, really high quality pencil that works real well. But I also substitute once in a while for special texture or for special colors. I can't get in that. I use Derwent, which is Derwent. That's a colored pencil, and also Faber Castell. So with those three different kinds of pencils, you know, I kind of go from one to the other depending on the kind of paper I'm working on, the colors that I need, and how much area I have to cover, et cetera. But my workhorse pencil, though, is the Prismacolor.
Okay. So really pretty much moving away from paint. Now, did you always work in watercolors before the pencils?
Let me say this. What I've worked in mostly in the way of paint is acrylics.
Oh, okay.
And acrylics give you the kind of a cross between sort of a mixed media feel between watercolors and oil. And why I like acrylics is, first of all, they're nowhere near as messy as oil, and you don't have to work with them as fast as you do with watercolor. But the way they dry, you can put washes over them to create an underwater illusion the easiest of any of the color medias that you work with. And so I might have a full scene painted in of, say, a bass on a nest, and I can come in with a clear wash of acrylic and get every bit of the color saturation of the water in with just a few brush strokes, where with oil you'd have to work, you know, constantly with every color you work with to adding that color, the watercolor too, which is a laborious job to do that. So anyway, it works out real nice that way.
Well, yeah, and considering how many, I'm sure, you know, to expedite some of these processes is important, because I'm looking at, this book, Trout in Their Food, that you just,
it's covered pencil.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. And you got like 191 pages there, and probably at least two out of every three pages has one or more illustrations on it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of work.
It is. The illustrations take a lot longer than the writing. But a couple of things. One is they have so much impact for most people, whether they're a good reader or not. And second, that we recycle a lot of those illustrations to either sell them as originals or have limited edition prints made or use them for other articles and stuff. So it's not just a one-time use for those, usually, for us.
Oh, okay. That's good to know, too, for other artists out there about how to get more mileage out of their artwork.
Oh, yeah, you can do all kinds of stuff with them.
Yeah.
And normally the artist retains the copyright on it, you know, unless there's been some agreement before the art rendered and sold. So you usually will sell the one-time use of that art, but it's like for Five Fisherman magazine or for a book or what have you, but you retain the copyright to copy and use it for other uses too.
Okay. Need to take a quick break again, We'll be right back, and we'll talk with Dave Whitlock more about fly fishing art and illustration. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department, and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's KIENE.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. Again, that's 1-800-400-0359. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Dave Whitlock about fly fishing art and illustration. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Dave, a little bit about, since we're talking in detail about paper and pencils and paints and so forth, where do you concern yourself with archival quality? Are pencils archival quality? And I know the papers are and paints are.
Well, a couple of things. One is, I think when a young artist is just getting started, they're not concerned about that. They're more concerned about the cost of the materials than they are the future of that rendering. And but nowadays, I think that a lot more of the materials that you just would buy are already, you know, graded as our carbon. And so that, and that just simply means that they're not going to usually fade or get or change colors, you know, with time or deteriorate with time. And then the other thing you have to absolutely watch out for is that the air, the ozone in the air, as well as the sunlight, can just tear up artwork if you don't put the right kind of glass over it when you display it. You know, I don't care how high carbon it is. If sun shines on it for an hour or two every day, it's going to destroy it in several years.
Right, right. And that doesn't have to be direct sunlight, right?
No, it doesn't have to be, huh? No, just bright light. Just bright light will take a lot of the color out of a lot of stuff. You know, I've got a lot of books here in my library here in my studio, and of course, you know, just the backs of them are pouring out, and it's unbelievable how much color they've lost off of them, you know, how they've faded off.
Right, you know. Right. Well, I too have noticed that. I guess after, you know, when you start counting your life in decades, you have some art around for a while, and you notice that that's not as vibrant, or that's starting to fade, you know.
The acrylic paint that I mentioned earlier is unbelievably durable when it comes to ultraviolet radiation. It just seems to be almost, you know, unaffected by something like oil and watercolors. Of course, watercolors are the worst of it. They'll fade out in 2 or 3 years, you know, or oils will start to age maybe 10, 15, 20 years.
Well, I was going to ask you about preserving matting and framing, and we did get a question in on the internet from Dan Ward in Clarksville, and he says he has one of your prints, and what would be the best way to preserve it? And I'm not sure quite what kind of prints he has, if it's like inkjet print or a lithograph or what. But is there, do you spray those, or do you suggest spraying them to preserve them?
Well, most generally, when someone purchases art from me, it's already been coated with a graphic art fixative that basically makes it relatively soil-proof, you know, and fade-proof. But you still want to, if you plan to keep that for a few years, you still want to mount it with ultraviolet radiation resistant glass.
Okay.
And then also try to keep it out of direct sunlight, you know.
Yeah, definitely out of direct sunlight,
yeah.
But that glass is expensive, though, isn't it?
Well, it is, but
you
know, a lot of times when we do a pretty good size painting, we'll say an 18 by 24 painting, the frame may cost $300 for it, but it's going to preserve the work, you know, far better than a cheap frame with bad glass on it, so.
Yeah, I guess you kind of have to look at it and say amortize that over the life of the artwork, which could be, you know, 50, 70, 100 years, you know. So.
Absolutely. And they can get really valuable, you know, after an old part like me dies or something. So, you know, with that type of aging, they can improve a lot in their value. But if you let one fade, well, hell, they're pretty well worthless. You know, they on the market, people won't buy them.
Well, Dave, just make sure you leave a forwarding address so that
you know,
all those future royalties will get to you wherever you go, you know. So So what do you do for anything special in matting or framing that you do other than
First of all, I don't mat or frame my work myself.
Okay.
You know, that's a different art form completely, and we usually have different studios around this general area, Dimport, and you know, that's a talent all in its own. Big end, really not framing well, and so I leave that to them. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we got a question that came in from Joel and Sheridan. This is kind of backtracking a bit, but he says, "Dave, I too would like to thank you for your many contributions to the sport of fly fishing. My question has to do with your personal preference for your subject matter. What is your favorite subject to paint or draw? Is it fish, insects, water?"
Yeah. Well, Obviously fish. I mean,
okay.
The fish underwater or fish living, live fish in water, you know, that's my favorite subject. But, I've been asked more and more to do landscapes, fly fishing landscapes and that sort of thing. And I enjoy doing that kind of work, but I think that my uniqueness or my real passion is the things that happen, you know, in the surface film down at the bottom of a stream or lake. You know, I think that's where I really probably am the most skilled and probably the most experienced artist around now in that particular waterscaping.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What, let's take like, for instance, again, the painting you did of the brown trout. I say painting, but you said it was probably done in pencil, right?
Yeah. Well, depends on which one you're talking about.
On the front of that trout and their food.
Yeah, that's just colored pencil. Uh-huh.
That's colored pencil.
Yeah, that's pencil.
So what do you call that? Do you call it a painting?
Yeah.
Or do you call it a drawing?
You call it a painting. It's a, you know, you can, sometimes you can also call it a, you know, a graphic art.
Real illustration.
Because graphic illustration is graphic art because it's a little more graphic, you know, than it is true real. And the graphics of it allow you to point out certain particular things real strongly to someone who's trying to learn something, you know, the lines and the colors and stuff, the way they present themselves to someone who's trying to look at a trout and see what's really there, you know, or what's really there, a knot or a tide fly or an insect. The artist can, if he's skilled at what he's done, those kind of things, can really show that better to a person with a naked eye or a pair of glasses on than if they just had a photograph of the same thing.
Yeah. Well, taking that as the example, how long would it take you to paint something like that, start to finish? You said sometimes you think about it for a month.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
that trout that's on the front, like of that book, for instance, that's probably a day and a half of work to do that.
You're fast.
Well, for that simple thing, where there's no background, see? And the original for that is probably on a 14 by 6 by 17 format. But what happens is the time comes is when you start putting backgrounds in.
Uh-huh.
Just simple trout or bass or fish drawings. That's just a very small part of the time consumed in doing. You know, the kind of artwork that whether you're looking at a full scene.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I charge accordingly for that. You know, if someone just wants a portrait of their fish or just a fish jumping out of the water or something like that with a plain background, it'd be very economical. But if they want a full scene, you know, with all the background in it and all the mosses and rocks and shadows and insects and what have you, that doubles or triples or quadruples the amount of time
I understand that. Now, in general, are you working primarily by assignments, or do you try to, do you have a schedule of artwork that you need to get done? Does Emily line you up with all these assignments? Or?
Yes and no. We normally sit down and discuss what type of creative art that I have an opportunity to do, you know, for the next 3 or 4 months. In other words, just freelance painting and sketches and what have you. And then also the commissions that we have promised and the articles or the books or what have you that we're working on, the illustrations for that, you know. So we try to kind of combine it all together, and so that we can get out the things that have deadlines on them, but still the creative work too. And a lot of the work I'm doing now, of course, we're trying to sell as collectible art rather than as illustrations. Trying to, you know, And so they take a little bit longer, but I'm doing an unbelievably higher quality on them. It's the first time in my life that I've really taken the time, you know, to do each piece to as close to perfection as I can get it. When you do the illustrations for, well, say, a Fly Fishing magazine, you don't get paid a dime for those. All they do is make the article a little bit better or make it a little bit more sellable to a reluctant editor, but you don't get paid anything for those. So you have to do them pretty fast or you go in a hole worse than you would have just written an article, you know, so.
Or since you would retain the rights, you know, repurpose it in some form.
So the original's worth quite a bit, you know. And then we also do limited edition G clay prints of a lot of the really better stuff, and so that allows us to you know, to spend that extra time on the art that we don't get paid for when we publish it in a magazine or a book. I was shocked whenever I started doing full book illustrations that the publishers don't pay for that. The author has to pay for that. In other words, if you write a book and you want me to illustrate it, your publisher will not pay for that. You have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. You have to deliver the finished product, basically.
Yeah, and very few people who write books, you know, they're looking for an advance, and they don't want to use that advance to pay their artist. Anyway, but that's just, the economics and the in the business of it, on those type of illustrations like that. So if an artist really wants to make money, you know, in illustrating fly fishing subjects, they need to try to get more into doing their art with the idea of it, selling it as collectible art rather than as illustrations for particular publications.
Well, now, what was the first piece of art that you got paid for? Do you remember that, how it came about?
No, I don't really remember that because of, you know, I've sold so much over the years. In fact, a lot of times I even forget paintings and I'll see them and I'll on somebody's wall or something, I've forgotten I painted for them. But so many hundreds and thousands, I guess, not thousands, maybe, but hundreds. So it's easy, like people, it's easy to kind of forget their names. But one of the first that I really remember being a red letter day was the Federation of Fly Fishermen had a conclave at Snowmass, and I donated a spawning brook trout, a pair of spawning brook trout acrylic to them. It was on probably about a 16 by 24 mat, and they sold that at an auction for $3,000.
Wow.
And I almost fainted, you know, I mean, that's that. Because most of the work I was selling at that time, which, you know, a number of years back, was selling much more than $200 or $300 on the original. But it was a really nice little painting, but then the auction block, it really went well. So, and I remember the auctioneer told me, he said, "Now, young man," he said, "let that be a really good lesson to you, that your work's a lot more, you know, a lot better than you think it is. And you need to start thinking about raising the price."
Yeah, well, that's good. That's great.
Well, you know, an artist goes through several stages. One is that they give their art away, and then they begin to sell it for enough to pay them for materials, and then eventually they get to the point where their art sells at kind of a minimum wage, you know, so they can make but gradually, if people like them, and if they really do quality stuff, and they know how to market it, you know, they begin to get paid for their talent. And that can take a lot of years, you know, to develop that type of a market. But in the process of it, it's a wonderful pursuit.
Well, how do you determine the price of a drawing or a painting? Because you have time, but you have experience and your creative, you know, being that's into those, which you can't put a price on. So.
Well, that's true, and. A couple of things: the size of it, and how long it's going to take. For instance, if someone wanted to have me paint them a 24 by 36 scene of a brown trout in a river, if I did that in acrylic, I could probably do it for half the price that I would if I had to do it in oil, because it would take about half the amount of time to do that. And so, so a lot of times, and the same thing with your watercolors. For that same thing in watercolors, it takes half the time it would do to take on the acrylics. So you can see how, you know, a lot of your labor is reduced drastically by the media you use, or increased drastically by the media you use.
I wouldn't have thought of that, but yeah. So basically, based upon what you said about, you know, the lifeline of an artist and how he or she goes through and pricing their work. So at a certain point, it gets to be how much time you put into it, and then what the market will bear. I take it, right? I
mean, that's right. That's right.
Because and then what your reputation is that you've built over.
That's
the
right.
Years.
Yeah, you can. My art sells because I'm an iconic fly fisherman, and the people who buy my art know my work and know me, and that's why they buy it. They don't buy it for you know, just the art itself, but it's who's painted it as much as how well it's painted.
Right.
And that's really important for artists to do, is to develop patrons or people who like them and believe in their art. Because there's so much competition in the way of those same subjects, you know, out in a gallery or in a show or what have you. And so what sets them apart is, do you like the artist, and do you know him, and is he caring about you, and has he had you in the studio sometime or other, you know, and those are things that endear people to you. And once you develop those patrons, then they are anxious for you to do anything, and they're basically, you know, very interested in purchasing it, because they're collectors of your art.
Right.
And that's the solid of sales for most people, you know, unless they have some kind of a incredible reputation of being some kind of a scoundrel or some kind of international figure or something.
Okay. Well, we need to take another quick break. But before we break, Jane Marikoshi, wrote in, he wanted to know, are you going to be at the fly fishing show in Denver in 2013?
Absolutely, yeah. That's a great show.
So they'll be there, we'll all be there. And
we'll have some brand new art too, Dave.
Okay, so Jay, he's on his way. He's packing his bags already.
Okay.
Okay, we'll be right back. Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company is North Carolina's premier backcountry fly fishing guide service. They're located in Lenoir, North Carolina, at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains. They fish some of the most beautiful limestone spring creeks North Carolina has to offer. Their guide has over 15 years of professional experience, and in addition to their backcountry guide service for experienced anglers, they offer intensive full-day instructional trips for the novice angler. So go spend a day with them in fly fishing paradise. For more information on their services, please visit www.nc-flyfishing.com. That's NC for North Carolina -flyfishing.com. Or call them at 828-758-2446. That's 828-758-2446. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Dave Whitlock about fly fishing art and illustration. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive it immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Question came in on the Internet, and also it was a question by Martin Coleman as well. Scott Hood asks, Dave, of all your art, which painting is your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
Well, as I get better, I get new favorites, and I did it. I had an idea about a year and a half, 2 years ago. I've become a real fan in my artwork of sunfish, you know, and bluegill, you know, red ears, long ears, that sort of thing. And so I did this painting. It's called Six Southern Gentlemen. It's not a painting. What it is, it's a pencil painting, and of six full-size male sunfish of six different species. And they're in kind of a montage, a vertical montage. And that thing is so cool. And people like it so much. In fact, not too long ago, we had a little small art show for a fly fishing club. And one gentleman bought two copies of it because he said, I want one for my office and one for my home. And that's as high a compliment as you could have if someone buys two pieces of the same art to hang in their home and their office. So, but I think that's one of my favorites. And then not too long ago, for a gentleman in Denver, I painted a 24 by 36 painting of a big male brown trout along the bank of a western river, rising up and picking a grasshopper off of a blade of grass that was hanging in the water. And it's called September Hopperwind because it depicts a windy, you know, afternoon, and this big brown trout's coming up to get it. And it's a split level scene, you know, half above the water, half below the water. And I think that's probably our most proud of that wild art done, as far as just having a very strong visual impact. If you weigh the fish in it, you weigh 6.5 pounds. So
now, that's
how big it is.
Yeah. Do you have do you ever do a painting that you aren't willing to part with that you want to just keep for your own wall?
You know, artists talk about that all the time. Two things. One is that, yeah, they're almost all that way. You know, I hate to part with them, but that is along with me. Because they're a labor of love. They really are, you know. And you get attached to them. You spend a lot of time with them and get attached to them. And it's hard to. I talked to a very prominent artist up in Eureka Springs, Susan Morrison, about it not too long ago, and she said, it's not so bad to turn loose of them if the person that gets them you like. But the hardest thing in the world to do is lose a piece of art to someone that you don't care that much for. You know?
Interesting. Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's just part of the being a professional, learning to turn loose of those things like that.
A couple of questions came in on the internet here, Dave. Ken Wright in Canton, Illinois, wants to know, how old were you when you decided to go full time with your artwork, and why did you decide to do it then?
Well, I haven't gone full time yet with my artwork, but that is a really good question. When Emily and I moved to Oklahoma from Arkansas 7 years ago, we had been doing a really disproportionate amount of my creative time with fly fishing schools, and I had always wanted to get more involved in serious art. And so when we moved to Oklahoma, we built a beautiful studio for me here, and that's when I really got serious about, you know, doing collectible art, you know, paintings that people would hang on their wall for originals, or doing gift clay prints of them. And it surprised a lot of people because I had always kept a really low profile as an artist, and unless you read articles and some of the magazines and stuff, you didn't realize that those illustrations were things that I had done. And so a lot of people were kind of shocked when they walked by one of the fly fishing shows and see me in a booth with a bunch of paintings behind me with Dave Whitlock written across the bottom of them.
Right. Well, Jake Jones in Yukon, Oklahoma, I don't know how far away that is from you, but
it's a ways.
He says, Dave, I've read your book, Trout and Their Food, and often return to sections of it. I was wondering whether you provided any classes as far as your art goes. If so, could you talk about any services you offer there? Do you hold art classes?
You know, I haven't so far. Once in a while, I'll do that at maybe, you know, like a conclave or something. I'll have a little discussion about it to people, but I really haven't so far. I'm willing to do that. And one of the things that we have a program here for people who are interested in spending time with Emily and I, and it's just called A Day with Dave or A Day with Dave and Emily. And if someone is interested in fly tying or how to cast or just fishing with me or my artwork, we can arrange a day or two or three, whatever they need to, whatever they want to devote with that, on a custom basis. So.
Oh, great. So you could get some private lessons.
The answer is yes, if they're interested in that. All they have to do is just call and express their wishes, and we'll try to work something out with them.
Why don't you, give us the phone number they should call so that we get that in there right now?
The phone number to call here is Emily's office, and it's 918-207-0005.
Okay. I'll give that one more time.
Okay, area code 918, and then the phone number is 207-0005.
And while we're at it, why don't you tell everybody what your website address is, too?
That's just Dave Whitlock at DaveWhitlock.com.
That's your email address.
Yeah.
So DaveWhitlock.com.
Okay. Yeah. It's www. Yeah.
Yeah. Dave Whitlock.
Dave Whitlock.
Okay. Now you mentioned before you were doing G. Clay prints. Are you doing limited editions or open editions?
Yeah. And most of them are. Most of them are, and most of them are under 200.
So, limited editions or open editions?
Yeah.
Which one?
Pardon?
I said limited or open.
Oh, no, limited editions.
Limited editions, okay.
Yeah, most of them are 200 or under. It just depends on the subject and the size of it, but we're keeping the numbers real low.
200 prints?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah, 200 prints or less.
Limited editions. Another thing we do too is we usually offer two sizes because folks have, you know, limited spaces, or sometimes they have a lot of space they want to fill. So a lot of the prints are done in two different sizes if they are interested in, you know, having just a little guy or having a full size original.
Now, are those available on your website? Can people order them?
Some of them are now, and all of them will be before the year's out.
Okay.
And then we've done all of the pre-work to put it up. She just hasn't gotten it up yet, but it's done. So, and then we'll be, of course, adding, as new art comes along, we'll be adding to that website for that new art, too.
Now, do you do any lithographs, or is that old school now?
Usually not anymore, no.
And I think everybody's kind of switched to G. Clay's.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. We do our own G. Clay's, and Emily does such a job on them. It's unbelievable. We struggle for years and years and years, you know, with people reproducing art for us, and it never makes you happy. And so one of the things that most artists do, and I didn't really realize this, I don't think, until I started doing it, is that we enhance it. If we get a print, you know, when a print comes to in our hands, I look at it, and if there's something that hasn't reproduced properly, I go in with the media that I need to and perfect that and bring it back to the original quality. And it usually takes an hour to 3 hours on each print to do that. And but what you get is a really, really high quality, almost the original quality print. So, and I love doing it. You know, it makes me feel better when I send them out. You know,
I
know that when someone puts this up on the wall, it's going to look just as good as the original did. So.
Now, you've talked tonight about, you know, repurposing your artwork and trying to get as much value out of it as possible. Are you also producing your artwork on, like, cups or T-shirts or
plates
or other?
A limited amount, yes, we sure do. And, you know, it's simple artwork, and you know, just fish portraits and that sort of thing, fly portraits. But there's a nice demand for that. And in fact, I was over at a dentist office just yesterday. I had a surgery for an implant, and all the gals in the office when I came in held up their Dave Whitlock crop cups, and it was so cool because I'd been there over the last 4 or 5 years, and they've kept those cups, and they're still drinking out of them. So, and it's really, really good.
Would you suggest that that's something that, young artists should think about merchandising?
Yes, definitely. That's a way to get a lot of images out and make a lot of small dollars, you know. It adds up. It's difficult to sell large numbers of them like Harvey does, but usually in tackle shops, local tackle shops will carry a few, you know, you can sell a few through fly fishing shows, and you can sell, you know, some are over your website. So yeah, that's a nice way to sell product without having a lot of money invested in it.
Now, do you have to have a special licensing agreement with the manufacturers, or do you just hire that out and they don't?
Both. Okay. It depends on whether you just contract them to do a limited amount for you, or they want to represent your art in their product line. You know.
So you could go to a cup manufacturer and say, here, produce 200 for me. You pay them.
Yeah.
It's yours.
Yeah.
There's no licensing. Or you could license the image to a manufacturer and say, you pay me, you know, 50
yeah.
cents a
yeah.
cup every time you create
yeah.
one.
Yeah. You do both. We do both. Uh-huh.
So that requires legal agreements and so forth. Do you have an attorney that does
it's
that?
It's a contract. Yeah, this is just a contract. It is. Yeah. Between your attorney and theirs.
Okay.
And that's best to do that way. It costs a little bit more to do that, but it's a lot safer way to do. You know, you don't end up on the wrong end of the agreement if you have a good contract.
Yeah. Now,
I'm not that kind of a person. Emily does most of that kind of work. To me, that's just something that I'm not interested in or don't focus real well on. And so, thank God I have her that she's got a good business head about that. But our people that are what we, I guess you describe as artistic, usually don't have that side of their brain.
They're
really poor businessmen.
Yeah.
They're very creative and, you know, do a lot of neat things, but when it comes to, money and business and that sort of thing, we're better off having somebody else represent you. Right?
Yeah, I know how that is. And even some of the, like I told you earlier, I went to art school for photography and spent 3 years and not doing nothing but photography, but back and got a degree in it, but they didn't teach you anything about business back then. I guess they're including it now in the education, but
yeah.
a lot of the art schools never addressed that, you know.
Well,
and they need to.
Having looked at the income I've made over the years in this sport, I would definitely say that I would have, if I had known what I was going to do, I would have gotten either at least a minor or maybe a major in business before I would get into something like this, you know, because I'm very naive about a lot of that and didn't interest me, but I realized how important it is if you really are going to make a living from your talents, if you have a good understanding of business and how to market. You know, your time and your talents and your products.
Right. Now, Mike in, looks like Boiseville, New York asks, how would I go about starting to sell my fly fishing illustration work to book publishers? And let's make that book/magazine publishers today.
Yeah, I tell you, it'd be tough on books. The only way you might do on books is send them, you know, a portfolio of your work and tell them that you're interested in illustrating books, you know, certain subjects, and let it go at that. But for the most part, like I said, the book publishers are not really interested in acquiring artists. They usually leave that up to the authors to do that. And basically the same thing with magazines. Most of the magazines don't buy a lot of freelance art at all. Now, they buy quite a bit of photography, but not a lot of freelance art.
Okay.
And if you don't believe it, just look at the magazines, you know.
Yeah.
You hardly ever see any quality art, just through their pages. You know, it's usually, tied up in some kind of an advertisement or some art, which somebody else has already paid for. And then also, a lot of the magazines, may have a graphic artist, on part-time staff or something that do a lot of their illustrations.
So would one avenue possibly be contacting publishers that are publishing the kind of books you would like to illustrate and asking them to connect you with authors that might be needing?
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. I think that would work best.
Shows an understanding of how the business works, too.
Yeah.
I know when I first got out of school, the most important thing was to have tear sheets. In other words, something that was published or something you had been paid for.
To show
that you had worked under pressure and for a job. So I would think that for an aspiring artist or illustrator that, even doing the first book or something at little or no cost just to get the publication done as a showpiece.
I think that's what most people do. And I think that books historically, fly fishing books have sort of lived off of that. That there's always somebody around who's anxious to contribute their work in order to get the credits, and so they do it for nothing or just a few $100s because they want to rather than trying to charge a lot of money. But at least they get published that way, you know.
Right. Yeah, you've got something to show then.
And, you know, of course, nowadays, too, there are a lot of computer artists, you know, I imagine that a lot of the magazines and books and stuff are calling on those kind of people to generate images, which they can do a lot quicker than an artist can with paints and inks and stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Well, do you have any kind of, we're about out of time here, do you have any parting tips for upcoming artists to help them be successful out there in the art world?
Well, you know, the advice that I have gotten from people who I really did admire as artists and who have really gotten to where they wanted in art, has always been pretty much the same, and I probably passed that along, and that is that first of all, if you realize that you like to do art, you know, that's the first step. Then follow what you want to do, because that if you're ever going to be famous or really good, it's going to happen because you're doing your thing. And if your thing is beautiful and unique and wonderful and that sort of thing, it will sell. It will be popular, but if you're always trying to do something what everybody else is doing, what everybody else is selling, what have you, you're working at a big disadvantage to that. And I mentioned earlier, Susan Morrison, who has a magnificent gallery in Eureka Springs, and she found a niche in art, in wildlife art, that has been so successful for her, and she simply uses colored pencil and rotographs to do life-size North American animals. And the media of pencils and rapidographs doing a 9-foot-tall grizzly, it creates an illusion that nobody else has, you know. But she found that niche. But that's what she liked to do. And so she pursued it, and she's just a wonderfully successful artist because of that. You know, she's where every artist wants to be, you know, with her career and her esteem and the prices and, you know, the income that she generates from her art.
Right.
It's just incredible. But that's what she did. She found the niche and she pursued it.
Go with your heart, right?
And that's right.
Love and
because life's pretty short, but it's still a long time. And if you need to be doing what you want to do over those periods of time, and that will make it a lot more fulfilling than doing something that you probably wouldn't want to do.
Right. And a couple last parting questions here. If somebody wants an original of your pieces, or to do a commission work, I take it Emily will probably be posting originals that are available on your website as well.
Yeah.
And then commission, they just contact you by phone like we gave them before or the website?
Yeah.
Okay.
And one of the things that I like to do with a commissioned art is to get the person's idea of what they want, and I will even to the point of what season, what male, female, et cetera, et cetera. And then I'll do sketches of that, and if they like it, then I'll render the art. But it's a custom piece, so they tell me what they want in the way of a scene. And I'll render that the best I can to fulfill, you know, their dreams of it. So,
great.
To me, that's the most fun way to do is to work with somebody like that on what they always wanted to do and put it in, you know, and put it into my account.
Right.
But anyway, that's how it works.
Good. Okay, well, we've got to tie things up here, so when we return, and stick with me, Dave, because we're going to be giving away your book here in a little bit. When we return, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing Magazine, and we're going to give away Dave Whitlock's book, Trout and Their Food, courtesy of Skyhorse Publishing, and they're at www.skyhorsepublishing.com. So stick with us here just a couple more minutes, and we'll give those prizes away. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The pebble mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be also at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's www.savebristolbay.org. And there you'll learn more about how you can get involved and help out. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link, leave your comments there, and we'd sure appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. And for the drawings, if you're a winner of that, you'll be randomly selected from our show's registration database. Now, if you haven't registered yet, it's too late now. But do so for the next show because we're always giving away these memberships and subscriptions, and they're great gifts to get. So the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and if you aren't a member of that, you should be. To find out more about them, go to www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. And... hold on here. Give me 1 second. My computer's kind of acting up here. And nothing new to anybody out there, I'm sure. 1 second here. Hang in there, folks. Hang in there. I'm still here, scrambling. Okay. So, our winner for that 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers is going to be Ted Gardsel. Ted Gardsel, and Ted is in Connecticut. So, Ted, congratulations on winning that membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. I'm sure you're going to enjoy that. And our second drawing is for 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Flyfusionmag.com is where you go to find out more about it. And our winner for that is Camilo Santana. Camilo Santana. So, Camilo, that is a great gift to win as well. And Camilo is in Massachusetts. So enjoy that subscription. I know you will. And those that didn't win, go to flyfusionmag.com. You can subscribe there directly. Okay, now we're going to give away Dave's book, Trout and Their Food. And you win this, and you get to see all kinds of Dave's illustrations in there. So... and you'll learn a whole lot about trout and their food, which is the main reason for the book.
I usually tell people it's a clear window into the trout world, that book.
There you go. There you go. And it covers everything from damsels to caddis to terrestrials to minnows to scubs to sow bugs, to, you name it. It's those old San Juan worms are in there and everything. So be sure you check that out if you don't win. So the person that's going to win this thing, you need to go to our homepage, type in the answer to this question. And the question is, obviously a one-part question tonight, since this is a different subject. Dave said that in the process of doing his art, he usually would do his original or his starting sketches on tracing paper, and then he would move them to what kind of paper next before he got to his final canvas or illustration board. What's the name of the paper that was between the sketch, the tracing paper, and the final medium that he was going to paint on? There we go. Okay, we've got an answer here. Dave, you tell me if this is correct. It says that you transfer it to plastic film vellum and then work on the details and colors.
Yes.
So it was vellum is what I was looking for.
Yes.
So,
and
then he actually, you don't actually put the colors on there. You actually put the colors on the final meeting.
No, you can put colors on it, by the way. But
oh.
That before, for my purpose, for active rendering collectible art, I transfer it to real high quality paper or canvas to do that with.
As the final piece, yeah.
Yeah.
So Joel, and I don't know, Joel, are you in Sheridan, or is your name is Joel Sheridan anyway? It looks like it's Joel Wilson, possibly, from your email address. You're the winner of Dave's book, so congratulations.
Yay.
Yeah, way to go, Joel. And, Joel, you'll need to send me either in the same box you just put your answer in, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. Send me your shipping address so that we can have the publisher ship that out directly to you. So, and then if you're in Sheridan, Wyoming, then you should come down to the fly fishing show and get it autographed at the fly fishing show. Right, Dave?
Absolutely.
And Dave does a nice autograph because he usually does a little sketch in there. I think I have a few of those myself. So thanks for playing, Joel. Thanks for getting that right answer. And, Dave, I want to thank you for being on the show tonight with us and taking your time out. I really appreciate it. And I know everybody enjoyed a whole different show from us and learned about your art. So thank you very much.
Well, you know, it's thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about it because I really do love it. And it's a wonderful you know, it's a wonderful thing to pursue, and I hope that until I'm 100 years old, I'm still doing it.
Yeah. And it's something that you can do for a long time in your life. That's what's nice about it.
Didn't take much about vitality to push a pencil or a paintbrush.
Well, thanks a lot. Our next broadcast will be on September 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll be interviewing Robert Cunningham. And our topic for the show will be chasing records. Robert has been chasing world records for 2 decades and has many stories to tell. Listen in to find out about the rare successful record catches, but also on the far more frequent failed attempts and the angling lessons learned from each of them. Anyone who has ever dreamed of a world record, as well as any angler seeking to improve his fish fighting skill and techniques, will learn from these experiences and enjoy a good fish story or two in the process. So, join us for that show. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Housatonic River Outfitters, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673 extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.